Yeah, don't forget those. We'll move to the third case. Good morning. This is Lynn Sinkowitz versus Joanne Barnhart. Mr. Schultz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Barry Schultz on behalf of the plaintiff, Lynn Sinkowitz. In this case, the administrative law judge arbitrarily rejected any limitations in sitting to which the plaintiff testified while accepting her testimony concerning limitations in standing and walking. He failed to consider whether she could sustain work on a regular and continuing basis, in particular whether or not she would require at least 2 hours a week of time off of work due to any combination of her 10 impairments, which the ALJ found.
Mr. Schultz,
yes.
Forgive me. I think we have a bottom line question that's got to be answered here, because it appears that Ms. Sinkowitz has no medical evidence pertaining to the insured period. So why wouldn't that be the end of the claim?
Well, because she also has a claim for supplemental security income, and there is no insured status for supplemental security income benefits cases. That's only for disability. The disability insurance benefits has an insured status requirement, but the supplemental security income part of the case, the claimant would be eligible as of the date she filed her application, and there's no requirement that she be found disabled at any particular time. If she was disabled as of the date of the ALJ's decision, she would have been entitled to the SSI benefits.
So that can be any time.
That's correct. That could be any time.
So eligibility and time paying Social Security tax, et cetera, doesn't matter.
That's correct, because SSI is a welfare or a means-tested program, and you don't have to ever have worked in order to be eligible for SSI benefits. If you're disabled and meet the income and asset requirements, then you can receive those benefits. If you're disabled at the present time, there's no other requirements for that. In this case, the ALJ found that Ms. Sinkowitz was credible in her testimony concerning her limitations in her ability to stand. He found that and walk. He found that she could only stand and walk for 2 hours in an 8-hour workday, continuously for 15 minutes. But he rejected her testimony that she was also limited in her ability to sit. She testified she could sit for between 35 and 40 minutes at a time, due to pain in the knee and then pain in her back as well. That distinction made by the ALJ on this record is arbitrary. There's no basis for finding her credible in terms of her testimony on standing and walking, but not credible on her testimony for sitting. And the ALJ really didn't provide any basis for making that distinction. This claimant suffers from morbid obesity. She was 5'5 to 5'6, 290 to 300 pounds. She has arthritis, as the ALJ found, in the right knee, evidence of swelling in the knee, low back pain syndrome with evidence of muscle spasm in the low back. And there's no evidence or medical opinion on this record that this claimant, that these impairments would not limit a person or could not reasonably be expected to limit a person's ability to sit. And, in fact, in Social Security ruling 003P, which has been superseded but is the ruling that was in effect at the time of this hearing, the commissioner acknowledges that obesity can impact on a claimant's ability to sit as well as standing and walking. But that ruling doesn't indicate that somehow standing and walking are more likely to be impaired by a person's obesity than is sitting. They're all treated equally. Now, the Social Security...
Isn't it common sense that if you have too much weight, you put more pressure on your bones, your joints, as you walk?
Your Honor, I would say no. And that
oh, that isn't.
That it is not common sense. And in this court, in the Schmidt case, in fact, this court said that common sense often can mislead and lay intuitions are often wrong when it comes to medical phenomenon. And... the ruling, as I indicate, in the ruling, the commissioner herself notes that obesity can exacerbate problems in sitting. And there's no evidence on this record that a person who's that heavy, sitting with their knee bent, wouldn't experience pain and stiffness, as this plaintiff testified, on prolonged sitting. The ALJ should have had some kind of medical opinion on that basis. Now, the opinions of the state agency doctors find that she had no problem standing and walking or in sitting. The ALJ rejected that opinion.
Could we talk about the credibility determination here? Because we have an ALJ finding her not to be completely credible. And, you know, he noted that her complaints of extreme pain were inconsistent with the findings of all the doctors who examined her.
Your Honor, it goes to the same question, actually, because I think it's important to remember that this ALJ found her credible in terms of her limitations in standing and walking, and nothing that he said in his credibility determination provides a basis for understanding why he found her credible as to limitations in standing and walking, but not in terms of limitations in sitting. I mean, he rejected the opinions of the state agency physicians who said that she had no limits in standing or walking, and in fact he found her more limited in her ability to lift than the state agency doctors. So he wasn't relying on the opinions of those doctors in making his opinions. There has to be some basis for an ALJ to make a distinction, saying a claimant can do one thing but can't do another, if he's going to find her partially credible. For example, the ALJ found that she did not receive the type of treatment that would generally be expected of a totally disabled individual.
Well, in total, she sought medical treatment only 7 times in 8 years, or...
Well, yeah, if you look at the entire period of time, that's correct. That is correct. But she started seeing doctors on a more regular basis as of 1999, which is before that she didn't see, or she saw a doctor one time. So really all of her treatment was after 1999. But the ALJ found that she suffers from 10 distinct medical impairments. Now, perhaps the ALJ could have, on this record, found that some of those impairments weren't supported in the record. But that's not what he found. He found that she suffers from 10 impairments, and, for instance, he found that she suffers from migraine headaches, but then didn't find any limitations due to those headaches. He didn't say how often she might experience them or whether they were ever debilitating. He found that she suffers from abdominal pain, but then again, he doesn't find that whether or not she was experiencing pain that might be distracting during the week. He found that she suffers from an anxiety disorder, and she said that a couple of times a week she experiences panic such that she can't leave the house or she has to come back home if she's out. But the ALJ doesn't make any specific findings as to whether she has those panic attacks or not. Those issues are important because the vocational expert testified that if even twice a week for an hour this claimant was unable to work or unable to perform her work, she would be all work would be precluded for her. And she testified that if we add everything up that she said, it would be something over 7 hours a week where she would have been unable to work. So even if she was exaggerating some of her limitations by threefold, according to the vocational expert, she would still be precluded from working. And the ALJ made no attempt to determine whether she was actually experiencing headaches during the week, because he found she had the headache impairment, whether she was experiencing any of these other symptoms to which she's testified. And I believe that this
would
this
matter if the as far as this supplemental security income, would it matter if the overriding problem is obesity? I mean, that doesn't go away. I mean, that's she's obviously got lots of problems just with that. These other things may be subordinate to that or may be affected by it. I don't know. But I just wonder, does it matter? Just say her primary problem is obesity. Does that matter? Is that enough to be to qualify?
Yes. And in the ruling 00-3P, the commissioner specifically says that obesity on its own can be disabling if the evidence shows that. And in addition, the ruling recognizes that obesity often exacerbates problems caused by musculoskeletal impairments, pulmonary impairments, and even depression or psychological impairments all of which Ms. Sinkowitz suffers from.
Isn't it true that in the 8-year period she claims she only visited doctors 7 times with all these ailments?
The record does indicate that.
When she claims to have been totally disabled.
That's correct. And I would agree that the record doesn't establish that her condition was disabling prior to the 1999 when she started being treated for all of these conditions.
And she didn't receive any treatment until the mid-1999.
I think one treatment in 1998 for her something, but yes, that's correct. Otherwise, that's correct.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Hammond?
May it please the Court, I'm Melinda Hammond for Commissioner Barnhart. Although the claimant in this case testified to a variety of symptoms which would be disabling if they were accepted, she presented very little medical evidence to support her claims that she's been unable to work since 1993.
Now, you too mentioned, you agree with him that this onset date doesn't mean anything?
I agree.
The eligibility date?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Schultz accurately described the two programs. Disability insurance depends on your earnings record. You have to become disabled in a certain period of time after you quit earning or you lose eligibility for that. Supplemental security income is a needs-based program. It doesn't matter that you've never worked. If you were poor enough and disabled, you would get supplemental security income after you apply for it.
From what date?
From the date of you can't get it any earlier than you apply. So she could, if she was disabled for the whole time after, it would be 1999.
And not 1999
when she applied.
Thank you.
Sure. Actually, to answer another question about eligibility that you asked later, Judge Mannion, on obesity, the commissioner recognizes that obesity is a medically determinable impairment. It doesn't matter that it's, you know, that it's theoretically curable. Our listings in recent years take a rather fatalistic view towards treatment for obesity and acknowledge that they're rarely successful. So that's no reason to discount it. In this case, though, the medical evidence shows that her obesity limited her, and the ALJ found that she was very limited, but it didn't prevent her from doing all work. When the Social Security Administration sent her to a doctor in 1999, she alleged she was unable to work because of daily headaches, but she offers no evidence that those headaches were ever severe enough to cause her to report them to a treating doctor who could have offered her help. When she sought medical treatment for leg pain in July 1999, she told Dr. Lim she'd been well until a few weeks earlier. Dr. Lim saw Ms. Sienkiewicz twice in 1999 for leg pain, and the medications he prescribed appear to have worked since she did not return to him for over a year.
Ms. Shaman, could I? Forgive me for interrupting you, but I'm sitting here and trying to think of all the Social Security cases that I've seen over the last 20 years. And I'm thinking that it's pretty unusual, isn't it, to have 10
medically determinable impairments?
Right.
Yeah. Not really, Your Honor. And what matters is, although she had those diagnoses or complaints, the ALJ adopted every limitation suggested by every doctor in this record.
In other words, what I'm saying is I've seen many with, 3, 4, 5, but 10.
What matters is the severity. I mean, she could be diagnosed with a hangnail, and that would add to the list, but it wouldn't impact her functional ability. And I'm not suggesting that obesity is a hangnail or anything like that. But
I mean, none of these are hangnail-type impairments.
But the fact that the ALJ found that it was a medically determinable impairment and ought to therefore be evaluated doesn't mean that it was necessarily disabling. It doesn't even mean it was necessarily severe. He found that she had a severe impairment with all these together, and he found that she had significant limits. But, for example, her plantar fasciitis, she complained of that to Dr. Lim in, 3 times in 2000 and 2001. She went in one time, and he suggested massage and stretching, And she came back 2 months later saying, no, it's not better, it's really hurting, and asked for an injection. He gave her an injection, which he wrote offered immediate relief. 3 months later, she returned saying the pain is back again and reporting that the injection had given her excellent relief. The treatment records here show that the treatment she got for these conditions managed them. And the ALJ gave her limitations, but didn't find that those were disabling. I'd like to address specifically the sitting argument plaintiff makes. He faults the ALJ for concluding that the medical evidence didn't indicate an ability to sit for the 2 hours at a time required by sedentary work. But the medical evidence actually supports the ALJ. Dr. Irahad, who acknowledged that she had obesity and asthma, found that she could nonetheless sit for 6 hours out of an 8-hour day. Dr. Kim, who acknowledged that she had obesity, that she had knee problems, that she had low back pain, and that she had asthma, found that she could still sit for 6 hours out of an 8-hour day. The ALJ's detailed discussion of the medical record included her waxing and waning complaints, the objective and the clinical findings, the treatment she sought, the treatment she was offered. This evaluation further supports his finding that she had no medical evidence of a limited ability to sit. There's no record that she ever told her doctor she had difficulty sitting. At Ms. Sanquit's hearing testimony, she complained frequently of the pain and difficulty she experienced while walking and standing and in her daily life, but she doesn't mention how her knees bothered her after sitting until she was asked by the ALJ. That didn't feature in her description of how her impairments limited her. It was only when she was asked that she offered that up. Additionally, she described that symptom of her leg feeling cramped after 40 minutes of sitting in much less dramatic terms than her other pain. Based on the medical evidence, the treatment record, and the degree of her alleged symptoms, the ALJ could reasonably concluded that no limitation on sitting was warranted. But in the alternative, even if the ALJ should have accepted her allegation that she needed to move around after 40 minutes of sitting, the ALJ's decision must still be affirmed. The ALJ posed an alternative hypothetical to the vocational expert, assuming all the limitations in the residual functional capacity and additionally assuming that the worker could sit for only 40 minutes, then would have to stand up for a minute or two before sitting again. This is a transcript, page 317. In response to this hypothetical, the VE testified that 1,000 hand packager jobs in the Chicago region would accommodate these limits. As in the case of Schrammick, the ALJ cured any error by obtaining alternate vocational evidence, and the ALJ's findings that a significant number of jobs remain available should be affirmed. Therefore, the commissioner's position is that the ALJ properly evaluated her ability to sit, properly evaluated the medical evidence related to that, but even if the court finds he didn't, the case needs to be affirmed because even if she had that limitation, she could still perform a significant number of jobs. I'd just like to point out that the ALJ gave a number of reasons for finding her not completely credible. He discussed her daily activities, including the ability to care for her daughter. He noted that caring for young children at home can be quite demanding, both physically and emotionally. He noted that when she had been asked how she spent her day, she reported that she did various household tasks and walked her daughter home from school. And he noted that although she alleged an inability to concentrate due to either her alleged mental problems or her pain, that she nonetheless drove, did errands, visited family, read, watched TV, played cards and games. Further, the ALJ found that her medical treatment was not the type of care one would expect for a totally disabled individual. It was routine and conservative in nature. He noted that she had been prescribed and had taken appropriate medications, which weighed in her favor, but that the medical records reveal that the medications have been effective in controlling her symptoms. As I noted earlier, Dr. Lim's injections and medications and conservative therapy worked. When she went to the one treatment record we have from Dr. Figueroa, showed that Dr. Figueroa just refilled her prescriptions, didn't feel the need to up any dosages of anything or change anything around. The ALJ could reasonably infer from that evidence that the treatment that was being offered was controlling her symptoms. The ALJ noted that she hadn't sought treatment from a psychiatrist or counseling, even though she alleged severe anxiety and depression. The ALJ also discussed the medical opinions in support of his evaluation of her credibility. He noted that the record did not contain any opinions from treating or examining physicians that the claimant was disabled or that she had greater limitations than found in his RFC finding. He noted that the opinions of the state agency reviewing physicians support a finding of not disabled. He notes those opinions don't deserve as much weight as those of an examining or treating physician, but that they deserve some weight particularly because of a number of other reasons caused him to reach the same conclusions. All in all, Your Honor, this ALJ provided a detailed analysis of this case. The slim findings on medical exam support his analysis, and the ALJ adopted every limitation suggested by any doctor in the record to find her not disabled. The vocational expert testimony showed that a significant number of jobs remained in the economy that she could perform, and the commissioner's decision should be affirmed.
Okay, thank you. I believe your time expired. So the case will be taken under advisement. Thanks to both counsel. We'll move on to the next case.